many times, and this is her yearly routine to come through here. So she's back again, and so help me give Sherry a warm welcome, okay?
Hi, I'm Sherry Malkoholic. My sobriety is March 14th of 2001. I have a sponsor and a home group, and hi to everyone dialing in on Zoom. This is a little weird. I only really have been attending like one in-person meeting a week for like 4 weeks. So this is like, holy cow. Ah, people. I always warn you guys up front, I'm not someone who has a pat talk. Only God knows what I'm going to tell you tonight, because it changes every single time. I tell you like a little tidbit that you haven't heard before. But I'm here like the reading to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I definitely do feel like this group is a little bit of family to me. My sister and her family live in Moneta, and so I go down to the lake and spend time with them. And this is like my nice little break on the way back. I have dinner at the Pig and Steak and come here and spend an hour or so with you guys, and then and head on back home to the DC area. And I asked God to help me to share his message and not my mess. So we'll see what happens. And, you know, I grew up just outside of Baltimore, Ellicott City, kind of Glendale area, for anyone that is familiar. In a house that my dad had built. We had, you know, a fence and a dog, and you know, on paper, I had everything that I should need to like succeed and like feel good and whatever. But the reality is it was a very dysfunctional household. My mom is incredibly mentally ill. It has only gotten worse over time, breaks my heart constantly. You know, and we, to be honest, we just had another kind of a incident over the past month or so. So it remains difficult. And at that time, my dad traveled a lot for work. So I was kind of in a little precarious situation. And then on the inside, I always felt kind of awkward, uncomfortable. I wasn't really sure how to interact with other people. I was always in my head, always thinking like, oh, there's Billy in the hallway. Should I say hi? What if I say hi and he doesn't say hi back? What if I say, you know what I mean? Like just this constant like hamster on the wheel, conversations going on. Before they happened, after they happened, oh, that didn't go well. Maybe I should have said this, and Billy would have said that, and then I would have said this, and everyone would have laughed. You know, like just this, like so much self-centeredness, so much constantly thinking about myself and how you perceived me from my earliest recollections. I mean, I would even, as far back as I can remember, even in interactions with my mom as a kid, I would lie, and no one taught me how to lie. I like instinctively just knew how to lie. I would lie when you knew I was lying. I would lie when this truth would serve me better. I would lie. You know, I was just wired real tight. And what happened for me is, you know, and the truth is at that time, I didn't have language for this. I just assumed everyone felt this way. I was not good at making friends. I was, you know, like I said, real awkward, real weird. And, you know, but what happened is as I was kind of heading into high school, there was kind of this corner in the building, right? And so you could see out from this side and from that side, you could see if like teachers and stuff were coming, and that's where we'd smoke cigarettes. And my parents had always smoked cigarettes. So I was like, okay, this is my place. I know how to do this. And those kids really looked like they did not care what you thought about them. And God, I needed that so much because I so desperately cared what you thought about me. And, you know, of course, smoking cigarettes is very quickly, you know, followed by drinking and all sorts of other things. And gosh, drinking really plugged me into this world. You know, all of that insanity that would go on in my head was relieved when I would drink. It's like that moment in The Wizard of Oz, right? When it goes from black and white to full Technicolor, and it's like magical. And like, I just remember I could breathe. And I felt like I didn't need to worry about what I was doing with my hands. Like I could just like interact with other people. And as I've stayed sober, I've sort of kind of tried to think about it, because I am like a very like heady, anxious person, even today. And I really think what it did is it allowed me to be present without all of that self-centeredness. I could really be present in this moment with other people and kind of feel comfortable and loosen up and like have a good time and like talk to people. And I was utterly incapable of being present, you know, on my own. And I mean, my high school drinking was amazing, right? Like if I could have kept that drinking, which also sounds crazy because I was not obviously supposed to be drinking, but if I could have like stayed in my high school drinking, like you'd have a different speaker, right? Because kind of what facilitated that is right as I was going into high school, my parents separated. My dad was no longer willing to tolerate how things were going at home. He started to not travel as much for work and was starting to see what was going on. That was like a really crazy 2 or 3 year divorce situation, very, you know, embattled and bitter. And so what happened there is, you know, the only person who had like a clear, strong voice moved out of the house. And I was very clear that I could now do whatever I wanted. You know, I instinctively knew that, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, but what would happen is I went from someone who had been involved in all these activities. You know, my mom had me signed up for Girl Scouts and drama learning camp. And I was on a competitive jump rope team and I played field hockey and lacrosse and soccer. And I played the violin, the French horn, the flute, the oboe, school choir, church choir, Girl Scout summer camp. I went horseback riding. I mean, I even did a semester of baton twirling. I mean, my mom had me signed up for everything you could ever possibly think of. And so, you know, I was in gifted and talented programs and like, you know, had my IQ tested and all of these things. And so I had come into high school, you know, a multiple sport athlete in the band, in the choir, in honors classes, all of these things, you know, and actually, honestly, throughout the years, I had hoped one of these things would be it, you know what I mean? Where I'd be like, oh, this is it. Okay. I feel good. You know what I mean? That was never the case. And so I go into high school with all of those things and very quickly, you know, they go up on the scale against my drinking, you know what I mean? And one by one, they fall off because I cannot do both. And only one of them really makes me feel good, you know, but what comes with that is that lying that I talked about, you know, I am a master manipulator. I'm a liar. I'm a cheater. I'm a thief, you know? And so some of these well-meaning adults in my life, right, would start to ask questions as you might like, hey, Sherry, what's going on? Like all of a sudden you're failing this class. All of a sudden you're not playing lacrosse. All of a sudden you're not in the bands, you know, and I would look you dead in the face and tell you how hard things were now that my dad wasn't home, you know, and if you really started pushing, I would cry. Do you know what I mean? Like on cue, you know, another Wizard of Oz reference, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Do you know what I mean? Look over here at this, you know, I would protect my drinking with anything. I would put any card on the table that would have you look anywhere than like what I was actually doing. And when my dad, like I said, left, I became a latchkey kid. So I'd ride the bus home and like, you know, get messed up and watch Jerry Springer. It came on at 3:30 in the afternoon. It was like my jam, you know? And then on the weekend, my mom would go out with her friends and I would send someone to the drive-through liquor store. There was like one in Langley Park and they would go and buy like 3 cases of 40s of Hurricane and we'd have a party at my house. You know what I mean? And what started to happen during that time is I would have told you that I cared about my mom, that I loved my mom, I loved my sister, I loved my family. But I could not equate that, like, I was allowing strangers into my family home that were just going to act however they wanted to act because they were drunk. And that I just, you know, like, I couldn't, like, see the connection that, like, actually my first consequences were very internal and that I was already lying about what I valued and believed in. And that, you know, if I told you that I loved and cared about my mom, but my actions did not support that, then again, one more time, I am a liar. And I have also, fun fact, allergic to everything. So I'm on like 3 different allergy meds because I was at my sister's. So I promise you, I am not sick. I literally, one of the side effects of one of my allergy medicines is a runny nose. I don't know how that works, but nevertheless, here we are. So, you know, and those things started to happen. I started to like push my sister away and kind of get more into this this lifestyle. And I went from, like I said, being in honors programs, doing all of these activities, having all this potential to barely graduating on time. Like my final semester, I think I took like consumer math, you know, like just I need one more to get out. And I remember thinking like, thank God that's over. You know, like I'm not going to college. This is terrible. Mm-mm. And if you drink like me, you know that very quickly I went into food service, right? Because I have never in my life been a functional alcoholic. I could never make a paycheck last 2 weeks, right? I am the type of alcoholic that I get that check, I cash it, and it's gone the next day, that night, you know? And so I knew that food service would give me that little $30 check every 2 weeks for my $2.30-some waiting tables, and I would get all my tips on a daily basis, and they would be gone. You know, and over the next 3 years, I really gave it everything I have, you know? All those tests I took said I'm very intelligent. You know what I mean? So I'm a smart lady. And I really tried with all of that, all of my willpower, to control and enjoy my drinking. And I could not manage to do that. At one point, I recently had like a memory bubble about this. At one point, briefly, I even tried workaholism. I got a daytime temp job, like filing, data entry. I would wait tables at night. And so I only had one day off a week. So I would go from my day job to my night job, go home, like fall into bed, wake up, do it again. I think I had like one day off. And that was the day that, you know, I would drink. But what slowly started to happen is I'm very good at interviewing. I can promise you that I'm going to be the best worker and I do such a good job and it's going to be awesome. And then some point in that first month or so, what I'm going to do is unintentionally no call, no show. I'm going to have every intention of coming and being there. I need this money. I know money equals booze, right? Like I have the connection in my brain, and I will mean to be there. You know, and then I will look at the clock and it will say something like 1 p.m. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, no, stupid clock, playing stupid clock games. No, but no, it's the real time. I completely slept through my job. And when you do that, you don't have a job anymore, you know? And so I had a lot of that go on and just the like struggle of, you know, for me, this is an AA meeting. I'm going to briefly let you know that drugs are a part of my story. And I tried my best to also manage my drinking by, you know, playing a mad chemist situation. And this will bring me up and this will bring me down. And I can go to work like this and not be slurring my words or whatever. And that really sped up my bottom for sure. And, you know, what happened is I even became unemployable from waiting tables. I mean, at one point I delivered pizzas, like, and so what I did is down in Baltimore, it was called hacking. It's like a pre-Uber situation without an app. It's like not a good idea, but I did it because I knew I needed cash in hand. And the only thing I had left, which actually I didn't have left because to be honest, my dad had co-signed that loan and I certainly was not paying it, was my car. That was the only thing I had. And let's be really honest, I didn't have anything, right? 99.9% of the things I had in my possession, my family had bought for me. Let's be real clear about that. I lived at my mom's house. So there was a period of time where I had moved out and was living with different boyfriends, but I am a taker, you know, like I would get fired and then I'm just not going to get another job. You'll just buy booze, you know, and other people are not into that. They don't appreciate it. You know, they're like, no, you have to leave. And after a little while, I wound up back at my mom's house, was doing a little bit of hacking. But the reality was when I showed up at my mom's house, I was 80 pounds in yellow. That was the real deal. And she was like, you know, and there was like an intervention at the health department, and which is how I know how much I weighed, because they weighed me. And I would go to this outpatient detox facility down in Baltimore. And I'd get my little packet of pills, right? You come in, they give you your little packet of pills. And that I'm going to date myself. On the way home, I would stop by the Blockbuster by my mom's house. It's her little Blockbuster card. And I would get a video and I would take my little packet of pills, my video back to my mom's house. And I'm just not going to drink. You know what I'm saying? And that lasted for a minute. You know, at the time, all I could really describe it as was like cabin fever, right? Like, I just got to get out of here. I don't know where I got to go. I don't know what I just got to get out of this house. And upon coming here and being an AA, I realized that I was that restless, irritable, and discontent. Like my insides just were tightening and tightening. And I was physically removed from alcohol and other stuff, but I was not yet in a solution. you know, so I really didn't have a place to be. And even I had all these moments of clarity, you guys. You know, I like the reading that we start with. It talks about my relationship with a higher power, and our big book says that the entire purpose of this book is to help you find a higher power that'll solve your problem. And I had some moments of clarity. I mean, at one point while I was drinking, I worked the front desk of a hotel, if you can believe it. And I remember at least on one occasion, I opened that big phone book and I don't remember what I looked up, AA, NA, rehab, something, you know, and I wrote down the number and I put it in my pocket and I'll think, and I thought like, oh, when I get home, I'll call, you know, and I would get home and I'd be like, that's excessive. You know what I mean? Like, you're way overreacting here. Like, we just got to sort ourselves out. You know, it was just like, I always just had to like come up with a solution or something, you know? And, you know, when I had to get out of my mom's house, I went to a meeting of another fellowship, and, a few things happened at that meeting. One, and I hate to say this because I don't put any blame on these women, but no women reached out to me. Not a single woman like introduced herself to me or like welcomed me to the meeting. As a newcomer, I was incapable of reaching out to them 100%. But a new guy did, you know, a new guy introduced himself to me and he had money and I still had my car keys and it was back off to the races, you know, because I know what fixes this. You know what I mean? Like this, no steps, no inventory, no nothing right now, you know? And it was back off to the races. And it was probably a couple of months of that, of now this man was on house arrest. So his mom would bring him to the meeting and drop him off. So we had an hour and a half window to get some cash, go get messed up and have him back to the meeting for his mom to pick him up. That's the kind of drinker I am. And, you know, anyone who'll bankroll my drinks. But what happened is one day I called this guy's house and someone at the house let me know that he had actually overdosed and died. And this was another one of those moments of clarity for me, one of those windows that was fleeting and quickly lost, because I am especially stupid and stubborn. You know, I will ride this train into the ground. And I remember thinking like, oh, he just didn't do it right or whatever. But here's the other thing that was happening behind that, like ego flippant, like preserve my own ego response, was that I knew on some level, right, that if you had a friend, now this guy was as much of a friend as I could have at this point in time in my life. Like as much as I could have a friend, this guy was it. And a running buddy, you know, and I knew, right, that when you guys had friends, if something happened, you would at a minimum feel sad, you know what I mean? Like there was like but you guys, by this point in my drinking, I had two emotions, indifference and blind rage. That was all you could get, you know what I mean? Like I'm flying off the handle or I don't care at all. And, but I knew that like, I should feel some type of way, but I felt absolutely nothing. And I knew there was something wrong with that. And that was as far as I could get down that line of thinking, just like something is off about this. And I really kind of felt like you could split me open right from this like divot in my collarbone, down to like my pelvic bone, just kind of spread me open. It was like black sludge. You know what I mean? Like nothing good or moral or decent was left. And, you know, you guys, I grew up going to CCD. I went to church. Like I knew what the deal was, but at that point I cannot live both of those lives simultaneously, right? Like when you drink, like I drank, like I can't, you know, treat my neighbor as myself. I can't like care about other people. Like all of those ideas have to go out the window for me to drink how I like to drink, because I have to roll you before you roll me. And that's how that life works. And, you know, but I knew that there was like something off, and I knew that at some point, you know, I had these glimmers of a higher power while I was drinking. And I mean, literally, because I'm here, right? I have had a ton of near misses. So many, I mean, I should have been arrested so many times where they were like, all right, you know, be safe. Here's your warning, drive home. You know, or I was in car accidents. And the last one was actually after this time period that I just talked about. So this guy died. I felt however I felt. I went back to drinking. And within another couple of months, I was on the rocks again, bad, right around Christmas. So I convinced my family that I should wait until after Christmas to go inpatient. Maybe that was the problem. I did this outpatient, right? Maybe I just need like an inpatient, like whatever I had to say to get the heat off. And I, if you're like me, I knew that there was a little bit of Christmas cash coming. You know what I'm saying? And I'm like, I can really get some good, you know, one last bender on with this Christmas cash. So I conned my way into like an after Christmas rehab. Went real hard at Christmas and right after that went into an inpatient facility out in Laurel. But what happens to me when I'm in a place like that, right? Once again, I don't have a solution provided by Alcoholics Anonymous and the care of a higher power. And I do not have the solution that's provided to me by alcohol. So I'm a psychopath. I mean, I feel miserable. Like I walk in there and it feels like my insides are churning broken glass. And as the days go on, the sound of your breathing becomes incredibly disrespectful, you know? And I'm not doing these chores, you know? No, thank you. And, you know, everything becomes problematic and agitating. And I start breaking those rules because I don't think they apply to me. And at that time I am, I'm 20. I'm 20. I don't need to be here. I have another run left, right? I have plenty of time left. So I get kicked out because I break all the rules. And I'm very indignant about it, as you should, you know, as any good alcoholic is. How dare you kick me out? I need to be here. Do you know what you're doing? They absolutely should have kicked me out. I was a terror upon the rest of the community. And I went out drinking that night because I would have told you at that point that it was really the drugs that were the problem. And if I could just, now that I was cleaned up off the drugs, I could just go back to drinking, right? And that would be totally fine. And I went out that night with my sister and her friend drinking. A few things happened that night. First is the alcohol stopped working for me. And what I mean by that is I knew I was as physically drunk as I could possibly be. I was drinking Jack Black straight out of the bottle, you know, like there's not, but the problem is I knew that, you know, my brain was running on all 8 cylinders. There was no blackout. There was no oblivion. There was no relief. And the second thing that happened is on the way home from being out, my sister wrecked her car. I love that car. She had a 1996 cherry red Camaro. And it was January, so it was a little snowy out. She's a new driver. She's 16 with a Camaro. So, we hit a little bit of ice. And on the way home, she flipped that car end over end off an on-ramp into a drainage ditch from 695 to 95 in Baltimore. The car was so mangled, her friend climbed out the trunk while the car was upside down. I had taken off my seatbelt. I think it was like to get a CD or something, you know what I'm saying? And I bounced off the passenger window and then went half out, right? Like I did the thing kids do where you splay your legs really wide so they can't get you through the doorway. So I was half in, half out of the car. It was another near miss, right? I wanted to lay there. You know, my sister calls out over me, is yelling me, get up. And I'm like, I'm good. I just want to lay here for a minute. She was like, no, get up. You know, and so we get up and some guys come by and clean out the car before the cops come. You know what I mean? And my sister got a ticket for failure to control a motor vehicle. Near misses and gray swims the whole way through my drinking. And I remember the next day I got a call from this kid that I had been in rehab with. Now, when I talk to the rehab, I tell them I don't recommend this. So one time this maybe worked out, but this guy I've been in rehab with called me and asked me what I was doing. And I said, I was trying to go to the city. And he said he and his sponsor were going to an AA meeting. And he was like, yeah, we'll just do both. Right. Like, I'm trying to buy drugs and, like, not. I mean, I have safety glass cuts from head to toe. What I didn't know is I had a ton of soft tissue damage in my neck and shoulder, which I'm still treating to this day, so I can turn my head. And, you know, but I was, once again, I know what fixes this. So this guy and his sponsor came and picked me up and took me straight to a Saturday night AA meeting. And I thought the guy's sponsor was cute. And I was too prideful to say anything about why we weren't going to buy drugs. You know, I was like, we'll figure it out later. And I went to a Saturday night AA meeting in Chevy Chase. If you know the difference between Baltimore and Chevy Chase, you understand maybe what I'm feeling a little bit, right? I felt like I had walked into like a Gap commercial. You know, I showed up, I had like my Timberland boots on and like a men's large snowboarding jacket. I still had the really big 90s bangs, you know what I mean? Like a half ponytail and, you know, essentially hiding the fact that I weigh like maybe 85 pounds now, you know, and they're all dressed really nice. And the reality is they're probably dressed like most of us are dressed tonight. But because I was so, I mean, when I drink, you guys, I'm not showering. Not brushing my teeth, certainly not doing laundry. You know, like I'm not doing any like functional people things at all. And so like the fact that they all looked like they had showered and were like in clean outfits that like matched and were like appropriate for like the day and time. And like, I was like, there's no way these people understand what my life is like. And, but the reality is that guy's sponsor shoved me up at halftime to go get a 24-hour shift. And I got one, and women came up to me after the meeting and asked me for my phone number. And it did not occur to me to lie, you know, for the first time in my life, probably, but it did not occur to me to lie. And I gave them my phone number and I started going to meetings. And the reality is this is if you drink like I drink, I didn't really have any old friends to like cut off when I got to AA. Some of them were in like jail, prison, some were dead. And some of them I just had, you know, rolled before they rolled me, or, you know, I was a liability at that point. So no one was like worried about where I was. So I was like, really, this was kind of the last house on the block for me because I didn't have like other avenues to pursue to keep drinking. And, I still don't know when I got here if I really thought I was alcoholic, but I really, my like everyday, right? My mom was kicking me out. I was moving in with my dad and his wife, and I had a lot of rules all of a sudden, you know what I mean? Of like curfews, and like I was not allowed in their home when they weren't there. If they left, I left. You're like, I was not, I did not have a key to that house. I did not have, you know what I mean? Like I was under. If you came to pick me up for the meeting, unbeknownst to me or you, my dad was writing down your tag number in case I like didn't come back from, you know what I mean? Like I was untrustworthy to say the least. And so the only place I was really allowed to go was like to the meeting. And so that's what I did for a while, even though I wasn't sure and, you know, I was uncomfortable. But where I go to meetings, everyone will ask you at every meeting if you have a sponsor. And if you don't, they will continue to ask you every day at every meeting until you get one. And so I got a sponsor. And this lady would take my phone calls. And at first, I don't know if we were really like working the steps necessarily, but she was taking my phone calls and like turning me towards AA related solutions, you know, and offering me a new perspective on my life. I'll remember, this is how, I hate to tell this because it tells you how self-centered I am, but I'm so self-centered, you guys. Like, I remember I was living in my dad's house and I had all these little tchotchkes set up on my dresser. And one day I came home and they were all kind of scooted off to one corner and there was like a little TV in my room. And I called, again, I'm going to date myself. I called my sponsor's house and she lived with a bunch of other sober women and she wasn't there. So I had to talk to her roommate. And I'm very upset about this. I'm like, my dad is storing his things in my room. She said, or your dad has offered you a small television so that you can watch TV in your room. I was mind blown. That had never occurred to me that someone would take an action that would be beneficial to me. I would always assume that you were doing something that was like outwardly against me no matter what. And I was like, these ladies seem to know something. I'm going to ask and find out. She said, hey, Dad, I noticed there's this TV in my room. He was like, yeah, I thought you'd like to watch TV. And I was like, and I would start to have like interactions like that where I would like check my thinking against my sponsor, like a woman with time, and they would give me some piece of information and they would be right. And I was like, oh, you know? And so as my brain kind of defogged and I was able to get through the book with a sponsor, like I did that and started working through the steps, and my relationship with my dad and stepmom improved greatly when I moved into a sober house and out of their home. You know, and I lived with this wonderful lady, Carol, who was renting rooms out in her house, and had a slew of other sober roommates. And I learned how to live with other people. You know what I mean? That lady is a saint, because everyone who came through there was like, crazy alcoholics. And she'd be like, you guys, we would just, but the deal is I learned, hey, you do laundry on Saturday. Like, here's how you go to the grocery store. Like, here's, like all of these things that I just never figured out how to do. And that's kind of been a lot of AA, is like figuring out how to do these things by doing them with you, by you being like, come on, we're going to the grocery store, or like, come on, we're going to go do this thing. And, I was still really hung up on this God idea when I got here. And what happened is I just believed at first that you believed. I was unsure, right? Because where I came from, I had done a lot of sinning, what I'm saying? And I was like, maybe it's better if you're over there and I'm over here. Like, I'll just mind my own business, And I was sure that a higher power was not concerned with me anymore. I was like on the blacklist. And what I've since learned is that like my image of self relates directly back to my image of a higher power. So if I think I'm the like sorriest son of a gun on earth, then my higher power must be a judge, must have a black book, and must be after me, And so I had to kind of slowly start working that like I could pray to Billy's higher power or someone else that I really felt like had a relationship with a higher power in the meeting, right? And I could pray to that higher power. And I started out, with like please in the morning and thank you at night. And I would have these little experiences, and I tell you guys some of these funny stories. They seem so small, but like to me they were like such a big deal. I was probably 6 or 9 months sober, and I got invited to go to the opera with like all these people that had so much time. They probably had like 10 years. I didn't know, Billy, like Mike and Bridget and all these people. And I was like nervous because I thought they were such a big deal. And, but also I've never lived in DC proper. I lived in the suburbs of Maryland. So I'm going to date myself. I printed out my little MapQuest directions, put them in the car with me, and I'm going to go to the Kennedy Center. And I started to get lost. And you know how it goes. I start to pray the Serenity Prayer. And the radio goes down a little bit. And then I say it again and it goes down a little more. Right. And then the radio's off and I'm just like saying it over and over and over again. And by the time I realize there's nowhere for me to go, I literally just pull over and I'm like crying and praying. And I just got a cell phone, and this person in the program called me and they said, hey, I just wanted to check on you. I knew you're going to the opera tonight. And I said, I don't know where I am, And they're like, okay, calm down. Like, breathe, let's breathe. They're like, what do you see? Like, tell me what street you're on, what's happening. And I told them, they're like, oh, I know where you are. They're like, okay, get yourself together. You're going to pull off. They gave me over the phone directions to exactly where I needed to go. I don't know if I could do that, like with the neighborhood I live in, much less in downtown DC. So to me, this was like a huge God moment, and I've had a few of those over the years, but that was the first one where I was like, this is it. You know what I mean? Like, I can see this. I could, it was no longer a coincidence or like, oh, that was lucky. And God was like, there is no way humanly possible that that could have happened. Like, it was like, I prayed. And then I got the phone call. And so sometimes it is for me like about getting the right phone call at the right time, like the right things just kind of lining up. And honestly, that happens for me about things that I want that I shouldn't get. You know what I mean? So I think it works, both ways, but I just kind of you know, made mistakes and dug my feet in. I am not someone who has come here and done everything perfectly. I will assure you that I have made a ton of mistakes in AA, made bad choices, been really self-will. But I think that you do not get drunk by making mistakes. You get drunk by defending them. You know, and so I would make my mistakes and I would have to take the inventory, you know, and there are sometimes I have sat back and wondered why, right? People that in my mind are better AAs than me. Of course, I don't get to judge that either, although I sometimes think I do, right? And I compare my insides to your outsides and find myself wanting. But the deal is, in my mind, some of these people were better AAs than me, had more service, did more, you know, sponsored more people, whatever, and have left and gotten drunk. And I have like pondered long and hard about this. Like I told you, I'm very heady. I'm very anxious. I will think this through at 3 a.m. for 2 weeks until I figure it out. And, you know, I, here's what I think is that when I hit these dark night of the soul, these like next layer of the onion where I really got to look at something I'm not ready to look at, I have been willing to do the work. That in these moments, right? And believe me, you can ask all my sponsors, I am a pain in the butt. I will kick my feet. I will complain. I will, you know, flop my arms. I will be like, I don't want to. Not looking at that. I don't want to do this. And then I will go home and I will cry in the bathtub like a real lady. And then I will get out and take the inventory. Do you know what I mean? Like I have belligerently done the work in AA. And I will tell you, I don't think that the steps care why you take them. They don't. I've seen people take a four step because their friend took one. I don't care, do it. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter. My motives in that sense don't matter. As long as I'm here and doing the work, like I have been able to stay here. And, you know, I have been incredibly sick in sobriety. I have had, you know, I've had different sponsors. That first sponsor that would take my phone calls and would like talk me down and turn my mess into some kind of a like solution when I would call her. At 3 years sober, she decided she wasn't an alcoholic. At my 3 years, obviously, I don't even know what, that's how self-centered I am. I don't know how much time she had. When I had 3 years, she decided she wasn't an alcoholic. Do you know what I mean? And I had to get a new sponsor. And then when I had 7 years, that sponsor died. And I was unsponsored for a year. I mean, I was like checking in with friends or whatever, you know what I mean? But to be honest, so at that time, my group was doing a lot of beach houses. So we would drive to Ocean City, Maryland, and there are a bunch of houses in Ocean Pines, and we'd go for the weekend and hang out. And I had suspected, like far off in the back of my mind, that there was maybe, you know, I needed to start thinking about getting a sponsor. And then I was on my way to the beach, and I almost fought a girl in a gas station. And I was like, I definitely need a sponsor. Like, I was like ready to, I was like, the Baltimore came out and I was ready. And I was like, I was like, no, ma'am, that's not sober behavior. And I had to get a sponsor and go through all of this again, did a huge four step again to clear out all of that nonsense from that year and that grief and all of that stuff. And then, you know, several years later, that sponsor made some bad calls, I'll say. She's a grown woman, she can do whatever she wants, but I was like, I don't know if I can stand behind that, you know? And I had to say that, you know, while I loved her immensely, I had to make a change, and I got the sponsor that I have today. You know, of course, she lived up by me, now all of a sudden she lives down the street from my sister, Monita. I don't know how that works, but you know, and I had breakfast with her this morning. She knows she's my sponsor. I am current with her, you know, and I've had to like go through some of these relationships. You know, I have had to act better than I feel in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. You know, when it got to, you know, when I had about 18 months sober, my sister got sober in the same group as me. Now, you know, I have feelings about that. I think I need to say who her sponsor is going to be, how she needs to behave at group functions. You know what I mean? I got a little bit of my feelings in it. And my sponsor was like, you have to let go. You know what I mean? And I had to step back again and let her have her own program and stay the heck out of it. You know, and that has been a joy. I know that there are plenty of people in AA whose family members should maybe get sober and don't. And so I'm like very blessed in that respect. And like I said, I was just at my sister's and her husband is sober and her kids have never seen any of us drink, you know, thank God, because we're a mess. And like I said, I've been incredibly sick in sobriety. I've had to be in the hospital. I've had family members die. I've had, like I said, this ongoing situation with my mom. And I made amends to my mom when I was new. But the deal is that the book says, like, we're God's kids. We don't call before anybody. You know what I mean? So that doesn't mean I make the amends and now let her beat me to death. You know what I mean? And not in a physical sense, but in a, you know, just call me with this insanity and try to get me to do what she wants. And that's not it either. And that's what I thought when I was new, that now that I'm sober and I've made amends, I just have to do whatever she wants. And that's also not the case. And I would go to this meeting called Promises, and I would get so resentful because this meeting was on the 9-step promises, right? So everyone's like, can't wait to go. I did a 9-step. I'm going to go talk about my, you know, going to talk about my amends. And they're like, me and my mom are best friends and we go shopping and we go out for lunch. And I'd be like, You know what I mean? And I have had to accept that will never be my truth in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just not meant to be for me. Like, but I have the ability to be there for people who have that experience. You know, I joke, the thing that people call you about in AA is not the thing you want it to be. Do you know what I mean? It's never like, oh, I wish everyone called me about this. Mm-mm. It's the last thing you want it to be. And you're like, cool. Okay. So, you know what I mean? I have to turn that over to a higher power too. And the deal is that, this year I've been like really afraid. Oh, I hate that. I also don't like when I have feelings. I'm still in that place, even at 20 years. So welcome to that life. But I've been afraid and I've had to really double back down on prayer, on meditation, on a relationship with a higher power. And I have been caught up in self, right? In ego. I like, I don't like, I want, I don't want, what I think I need to feel safe, right? To feel comfortable. I have these big needs, right? To be loved, comforted, and understood, to be respected, for you to think a certain way about me, to be comfortable, right? To have people act right, to have other people care about me. Other people do not have to care about me. That's the truth. They do not. So I have to have a relationship with a higher power that will withstand no matter what comes, right? And I have to. I struggle with people pleasing, right? So I need you to like me. So I have to really be careful about my behavior. Because I can very easily be like, well, everyone will like me if I do this. Insert action here. You know what I mean? But I have to care about me. And I have to have a set of principles that I stand on today. You know, whether you like them or not. That are grounded in my relationship with a higher power. That are grounded in that I have prayed and sat with a higher power and meditated upon what is the best action for me, myself, and my family. The best action for the newcomer. The best action for whatever the case may be in that moment. And it's not always going to, I'm not always going to feel good. You know what I mean? I had a nice run for a while. Well, I felt okay. You know what I mean? I was contented, you know, in my sobriety. And then 16, 18 months ago happened, and then we were all, and I am also self-centered enough to think that I'm the only one that feels that way some days, you know what I mean? And that's not true. We are all, I mean, I can't assume to speak for you, but I feel like we're probably all feeling a little bit, you know, of the nervous system, like burnout, you know, of like, what's right, what's wrong, I don't know what to do. And so many other things are happening outside the world, and AA is certainly a microcosm of the rest of the world. You know, we are no different than what's going on outside. And so it's like, this has to be a safe place for me. Like, this has to be free of all of that for me to come, whether in person, on Zoom, whatever I feel comfortable with, to like be a safe place from the outside world. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. And then when I'm on Zoom, I can leave the Zoom room. Like, I have options. I can speak up and say, hey, we're not going to do that here. But also, I've seen amazing things this year. I don't know why I'm having, Billy, you always get me here and get me into my feelings. I don't know what it is. I know. Billy always gets me down here, and I pray, and then God gives me feelings in front of all of you, which makes me horribly uncomfortable. I don't like it. But I've made really great friends on Zoom. I started helping out with a meeting in California, and I've met, you know, friends from all over the world. There's a girl there that from Paris, and I met this good friend, Jackie B, who I love, in Miami, and I watched my friend Ernesto get sober on Zoom in California. You know what I mean? He got his 1 year on Zoom, and I get to watch him meet new guys in the Zoom meeting and go pick them up in person and take them to meetings. I mean, obviously I don't get to see that part, but you know what I'm saying? You know, and it's like such a joy to watch people. I mean, the other week I met a girl in person that got sober on Zoom again in my area. And I was like, oh my gosh. Oh, I'm so funny. I was like, you're so much taller than I thought you were going to be. You know, so I get this little square. I am not this tall, actually, for the Zoom room. I'm standing on a stage. I've gotten, it doesn't have to look like how I want it to look like. That's the deal, right? All these big needs that I have to, again, third step, give it to my higher power. And every time I think I've given everything to the higher power, something else comes up. And I want to try to control that. And then I'm like, oh, no, that too, actually. You know, and I forget. 20 years, I forget. I think, oh, I'm going to figure this shit out. Sorry, Billy. I'm gonna figure this stuff out too. And then I'm like, nope, not that either. You know, and I have to surrender. If I knew how much, you guys, I was going to have to surrender, I probably would not have joined this outfit. This is a lot of surrendering. You know what I mean? Like, regularly surrendering. You know, of being like, oh, that also, I cannot, you know. I had a resentment. I had to be like, nope, not that either. Funny story about that. I don't know if you guys relate to this, but when I was new, I would have told you that none of my resentments were fancied. They were all 100% real and 100% justified. And the longer I've stayed sober, you guys, the more I realize that my resentments are fancied. They are only happening in my mind. They are not happening in real life, you know, like, and honestly, a lot more this year, I've really had to pay attention to my thinking. That's really what it is. Like, it's no longer about me going out and staying out till 3 a.m. and, you know, drinking Mountain Dew at the sober house, you know what I mean? It's like, the things that pop up in my brain are wild. I'll read a perfectly fine email from a coworker and think she's out to get me. I'll even call a friend. I'll be like, let me redo this email. And they're like, that sounds like a simple request. It sounds fine, right? And so what I really had to start working on sounds simple, but if you try this, it's very difficult. I have been working on trying to not take things personally. That any action that another person takes has absolutely nothing to do with me directly. And again, that's where I think other people have to care about me specifically. And if you're taking this action and I don't like it, then you are out to get me, right? And so I've really had to be like, this email is just a simple work request. Like, I'm just gonna do what this lady asked me to do. I'm gonna CC my boss like I always do when this one lady emails me, and I'm just gonna do my work. you know, and I have, like, I have, like I said, I literally have had to, like, double, triple, quadruple down on prayer and meditation. I'm going to more meetings now than I ever have in my life, you know what I mean? Because Zoom has allowed me to do that. And, you know, and it's really been beneficial. I've been able to really deepen a lot of my, like, Zoom relationships, because that, you know, I only see a few people in real life, mostly my family, some of which I'm lucky enough to have be sober so I can, like, have some AA talk. But I really just have had to try to, as always, take the action despite how I feel. You know, the answer is, sad to say, still more spiritual growth. I don't want it to be. Do you know what I'm saying? I want it to be anything but. Anything, like, can I buy it? Like, can I, like, you know what I mean? But no, every time I turn it, I'm like, oh, still more spiritual growth, you know? And I don't know. I just keep suiting up and showing up. And I'm not fixed yet. So if you're hoping for 20 years to do it, it's not at 20. Maybe someone else with more time than me will tell me when it is. Not 20, because I still show up every day and I'm like, really, brain, you're still, you know, my brain unchecked will go back to its factory default settings. Do you know what I mean? And those are not good. It's like, terrorize yourself. Take that action. Spend all your money on things you don't need to feel better right now. Like, you know what I mean? And I have to wake up and be like, okay, we're going to download the meditation app and the prayer app, and we're going to rewire this whole setup. You know, but I have to do that daily. So I don't know. I think I'm about out of time. I don't want to start rambling for the last couple minutes, but I really appreciate this group. You guys have always been so kind to me. And I always love coming here. Even if I'm hearing someone else speak, I just pop in and sit in the back and listen on my way home. So I'm really grateful to be here. I love you guys a lot. Thanks to everyone on Zoom. And thanks for letting me share.
I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. Oh, sure. You know, when you get chores and meetings and you get service work you get to do, one of the neat things about speaker seeking and calling speakers is that I feel a name come up and I call somebody. I mean, somehow it always weaves out to be a certain person.